Hello and welcome back to the album years. And well, we've been away for a while, haven't we, Tim? We've been away since October or November. When was the last episode we did?
It might have even been October. I'm not sure. It's quite a long time ago. I'm sure somebody will correct us. I'm sure there is going to be a major error having been committed to.
Probably so. Whatever the case, it's been a while. We are back due to incredible popular demand. Is that not right?
I think the words you're looking for, overwhelming love.
For those of you who don't know this show, basically myself and Tim just talk bollocks about music we love in a very opinionated way. And we should also point out in a very personal way. So we're talking about the artists that mean a lot to us. And I know there are people that are complaining about we don't talk about this artist, we don't talk about that artist, but it's nothing personal. It's nothing personal. In fact, it is. It's exactly that. It is very personal, isn't it? It's very personal. What I mean is it's not personal to the bands that we're not talking about.
What we're saying is we hate everything that everyone else likes. I think that's what you're saying.
Exactly. Just to clarify, obviously, that we are, you know, we're white men that grew up in the 80s, and that is going to kind of be reflected in the kind of music that we enthuse about and we talk about. And in fact, today, we are going to be focusing on 1981, Tim. And there's a logic for us choosing this year, isn't there?
There is, yeah. It's not only the 40th anniversary, it's obviously a year after, you know, broadly speaking, we started the album years and we started with 1980. So we're doing the year after that. And we're sort of interested to know what happened, really. How different was it? Because, you know, during that period, one of the things I remember is that music genres shifted constantly and that there was always some new scene or some new sound or something pretty radical happening. And to a degree, I'm sure these things are happening today. But I think at that particular point in culture, you and I were just the right age to be listening out for changes. And not only that, I think that music probably had a greater standing in the overall culture of the day. I think it was perceived as more important.
I mean, for me, I literally became a teenager in November 1980. So 1981 is the first full year when I would have been a teen, you know, and teenage years obviously is a very, very special time for discovery, isn't it? Discovery in all fields.
I was going to say, I think as well, it was kind of an interesting time because what you got in the late 70s, early 80s, as we probably discussed in the 1980 edition, was a fantastic collision of new sounds and old sounds. A lot of the older artists seemed to be learning from the newer artists. A lot of the newer artists were really broadening their scope in the late 70s, early 80s. So it was quite an exciting time of discovery for the musicians as well as the fans, really.
So we should probably crack on. So 1981, and Tim, you've put this list together this time around. So you've been quite specific here, I must say. Northwest Regional Post-Punk. First of all, maybe you should explain exactly what you mean by Northwest Regional Post-Punk.
Well, I think in one of the last album years we did, it was 74, I think, and I described it as being the year of prog. And by that, I meant that prog had infiltrated everything. And, you know, that could be a Willie Nelson concept album. It could be, you know, a grand metal album. It was everywhere. And I think that with 1981, that post-punk had kind of infiltrated everything. And in the Northwest, in Liverpool and Manchester, there was a massive scene of particularly distinctive sounding post-punk bands. And in the Liverpool scene, I think you had Tears for Explodes, Oak and the Bunnymen, who had a slightly more 60s psychedelic influence to their sound. And in the Mancunian scene, which kind of came out of Magazine and Joy Division to an extent, Martin Hannett, the producer, was a major part of it. And there was a very distinct sound and a distinct gloominess in particular to the Manchester sound.
So let's talk about some of those albums. I mean, some of my favourite albums in this category already, for such a specific, you know, kind of subset, if you like, of music, there's at least three or four records in here that I hold very dear. And two of them are part of the Factory. Actually, three of them. Three of them are part of the Factory family. So Factory being arguably the most famous label to ever come out of Manchester. And the association you mentioned also with Martin Hannett, also the design, Peter Saville. Yeah. This was that very recognisable sort of element to all the record sleeves, wasn't there? First of all, a certain ratios to each. I'm not sure if we've talked about a certain ratio on the show before. I mean, this is my favourite album of theirs, To Each. This was their first studio record. And they're kind of strange, aren't they? Because they're almost like what you might think of as a jazz funk band. playing alternative post-punk music.
Yeah.
You can almost hear the bass player's kind of frustrated Mark King fan or something. But the production is obviously very... Being Martin... Is it Martin Hannett the producer?
It is Martin Hannett. I think he did that one, yeah.
Oh, it is Martin Hannett, yeah. It has the same kind of signature production style as what Joy Division were doing at the time, had been doing with Closer. Yeah. So it's a kind of strange... They're kind of strange bedfellows in a way, aren't they? That kind of funk element with that kind of alternative post-punk aesthetic. But they weren't the only ones, were they? There was a kind of element of funk in quite a few of the post-punk bands, weren't there?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think there's another Mancunian band who came a bit later in terms of recordings. Anyway, Dislocation Dance were in that sort of field as well. And it's sort of interesting to contrast it with the New York post-punk sound, because obviously Talking Heads blended funk, jazz elements, because of course they had John Hassell on Remaining Light, with a kind of grittier New York post-punk narrative style. But it sounds nothing like A Certain Ratio and nothing like those Mancunian bands in that style. And as you say, I think part of it is Martin Hannett's signature production, which sort of follows on from what he did the year previously with Durity Column. I think it has that very kind of icy, almost like shards of glass in your face at times, the amount of sort of echo, delay and quite toppy processing. Mm. But it's an amazing record, because I think what you hear on this, as you say, on one level, it's almost like Chic or Mark King to come, this kind of good time funk, but with extremely bad time feelings. You know, this is as glum as Closer, if not more so in some ways. And the vocals have got a certain Ian Curtis quality as well.
Well, I think that I was just going to say that there's that kind of miserabilism, isn't there, about this record? And also a kind of deadness to the vocal delivery, a very kind of arch deadness, almost underachieving voice.
Yeah.
Which makes it sound very cold and very remote. I mean, when you listen to Talking Heads, it's this kind of sense of joy, isn't there? So maybe it's the Manchester thing, that kind of sense of miserabilism, because you've already pointed out that the Liverpool bands didn't have that, did they? There was more of a sense of sort of paisley inflected flamboyance about those bands, that the Manchester bands didn't have that. And you have that in Durity Column as well, which is the other album. Actually, there are two other albums that are from Factory at this time, from this year. Durity Column's LC, the follow-up to the record that we talked about on our original episode, called The Return of the Durity Column, which was ironically their first album. But the other album from this year that came out of Factory was the first album by a band that was to become incredibly influential and arguably made the greatest single of the whole 80s, New Order. And this is obviously pre-Blue Monday. They're still very much in that kind of miserabilist post-Joy Division pocket, aren't they, on this album? But there are elements of electronic music beginning to come in too, isn't there, that obviously will pan out much further as they go on through the decade?
Well, yeah, I think it is a real in-between album. I mean, for me, it's actually possibly my favourite New Order album, because I think what they managed to do is they're almost taking Closer further. To me, I always saw it as being an extension of what Closer suggested. And, you know, Ian Curtis was a massive loss, but in some weird way, musically and even vocally, this carries his spirit completely. And it is where you feel Joy Division would have gone. So I think half of the album is a very logical, slightly more expansive follow-on from what they've done on Closer and the singles such as Atmosphere. And half of it is that kind of electronic, even almost funk electronica that hints at what New Order are going to do. But of course, the vocals on this are, as with the A Certain Ratio, quite dead, quite Curtis. It is that Manchester sound of the day.
And we talked about this before, I think, with relation to a few albums. It's that idea that there's a certain album which catches a band between two worlds.
Yeah.
And it somehow has the best of both. And I think that's what I love about New Order's movement record is, you're right, it still has the sort of signature sounds of Joy Division, but it's in that transitional phase where they haven't quite become the electronic band they're going to with Power, Corruption and Lies and obviously Blue Monday, the classic electronic singles. But they're starting to work a lot more with electronic instruments and synthesizers. And for me, that's the balance that I personally love the most. I mean, much as I love Blue Monday, I don't love Power, Corruption and Lies as much as I love Movement, because there's still so much of what I love about what came before as well as what is about to come. And so for me, it's just capturing them on that in that perfect sort of just little 6-month window where they had the best of both worlds. And we've definitely talked about albums with a relation. And I think we're going to talk about another one later on that has exactly the same, without wishing to preempt, we're going to talk about Rush's Moving Pictures, which to me is exactly the same thing. It has the best of what came before and the best of what's to come. And to me, it's the perfect point to listen to that band and that record.
Well, New Order is still very much a band on this as well. I think one of the things that distinguishes it is that very almost ice cold tribal drumming, which you could hear on bits of Closer and certainly on Atmosphere as well. There's a lot of that on this album. I was always very drawn to that style. And I guess it's probably the last album where that's prominent, really. I think the electronics in terms of percussion take over from this point onwards. And Hannett, of course, produced the magazine album from this year, Magic, Murder and the Weather, which was the sound of a band falling apart. And I love it because I think you've got Teardrop Explodes, Wilder and Magazine's Magic, Murder and the Weather. And they're clearly the sound of bands that are falling apart. They're not getting on well. It reminds me a bit of The Smiths' last album in some way, Strange Ways Here We Come, where you can tell it's an unhappy band, but because they're pulling apart, it's very eclectic. A lot more influences are coming through, and in some ways, a lot more desperation and expression is coming through. So on the Teardrop Explodes album, for example, you know, they flirt with anything from epic acoustic ballads to electronic ambient pieces to Talking Head style funk. It's all over the place, but it's really exciting. And the Magazine album is sort of similar, really. It's Magazine in pop mode, it's Magazine in experimental mode, it's Magazine at times in jazz funk mode. And the Hannett production kind of enhances the weirdness of Magazine's final album, as it was for that lineup anyway.
And also we should mention Echo and the Bunnymen's second album, Heaven Up Here, which I think is my favourite. That and Ocean Rain are my favourite Echo and the Bunnymen.
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean,
we've mentioned Talking Heads a few times. You've also got a category here called New York, and you've got four records in this. Three of them are basically Talking Heads records, aren't they? Tom Club, self-titled, David Byrne's Catherine Wheel album. And for me, the best of the bunch, the David Byrne, Brian Eno album, My Life in the Bush of Ghosts, which has been hotly debated over the years as a kind of a forerunner of sampling culture, which is essentially what it is. It's a record of instrumental tracks where the vocal, quote unquote, is taken from snatches of found sound and speech. And I think there's even a track with a recording of an exorcism on it. But it's a fascinating. I mean, I did listen to it again in preparation for this record. I don't know if it stood the test of time fantastically well, certainly not in the way that Remain in Light has. And I think part of the reason why, for me personally anyway, it hasn't quite stood the test of time is because I think a lot of the tropes are so over familiar to us now, almost using sample voices as a kind of hook instead of a melodic vocal hook. Those things are obviously, you know, they are the very bedrock of modern pop music, aren't they? So, but it's extraordinary that a record like this was made in, you know, 1979, 1980, not released till 81, but I think they started on it even in the late 70s. And in that sense, it was definitely ahead of its time. And what's your take on it, Tim?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think on one level, it's very now in the sense that it dispenses completely with melody. As you said, it's using samples as hooks. And there is very little melody. This is pure sound design and rhythm, really. And I love it, though, like you, I prefer Remain in Light, partly because I prefer, you know, Byrne in that role as kind of vocalist, narrator, and some of the more unexpected elements that happen with Remain in Light. I think Remain in Light kind of hits my sweet spot because it manages to be both experimental, but also incredibly accessible and memorable. You know, this is very much a research and development album, and it's great. And when we talk about the New York thing, again, it comes into this Northwest regional post-punk, doesn't it? That you had a very distinct Liverpudlian sound during the post-punk era, a very distinct Mancunian sound. And there's that very distinct New York melting pot sound as well. And, you know, obviously Remain in Light has it. David Byrne's The Catherine Wheel, which is brilliant, has it. This has it. But also I think that people like King Crimson, Gang of Four, John Hassell, all of this kind of comes out of that melting pot. You know, when King Crimson reemerged in 1981 with Discipline, it's weirdly quite closely linked with that kind of New York experimentation. And Gang of Four, though on one level quite a British political post-punk band, to me a lot of their rhythms and their approach seem to be more Talking Heads than it did Joy Division or XTC or Wire.
So maybe because I've just mentioned it, we should move on to the category progressive and progressive related, because I mentioned the Rush album being another example of an album that is catching a band kind of at a perfect point between two worlds, between traveling from one world to another. And there are many Rush albums I don't know, to be fair. I should say that in complete transparency. But I think this is, of the ones I do know, this is the best, in the sense that it has the best of the pop sensibility that is to come, the more kind of keyboard orientated sound that is to come, and their roots as a classic progressive hard rock band. Just great songs on this record. I think some of these songs are, you know, have become real evergreens, haven't they? Songs like Limelight and Tom Sawyer, you know, they're kind of staples of classic rock radio, aren't they? Because they are essentially great pop songs.
I think you're right. I think that Permanent Waves kind of hints very strongly at this. I mean, Permanent Waves is also in between worlds, because you can hear Hemispheres in Permanent Waves, but then you can hear Moving Pictures and the more concise, more pop-oriented direction to come. But, you know, for a pop album, it's really uncompromising. You know, you talked about Limelight and, you know, it's a very natural sounding, great rock pop piece, but it's in several time signatures. It constantly shifts. And what's great about this album in a way is there's no sense of compromise. I mean, it's really quite accessible. It's very contemporary as well. I mean, whatever we say, this is coming from a progressive and a hard rock background. But actually, in terms of the sort of the razor edge guitar production, in terms of that toppiness in some of the drum sounds, it's very 1981. You know, this is a band completely in control of the era they're in while being completely true to where they came from.
You can definitely hear they've been listening to The Police, can't you, for example. You know, on a song like Vital Signs, there's obviously that, you know, that sort of Regatta de Blanc White reggae aspect to that song. And I think in a lot of Alex's guitar tones on this record, you can hear he's been listening to Andy Summers. Yeah, and I'm not so familiar with Permanent Waves. I mean, I do know it, but it seems to me, and I might be wrong about this, it seems to me this is also the album where Geddy leaves behind completely the kind of shrill, shrieking aspects of his vocal delivery. It's like you use the word relaxed, and I think that's a very good way of putting it. His vocal delivery on this record seems more relaxed, more natural, less the kind of vocal that's likely to turn off somebody as much as turn them on. Because, you know, however much you love early Rush, it's a very much an acquired taste, because of the vocal approach.
I think you're right. I think there are elements on it on early tracks. I mean, certainly with Permanent Waves, it's not particularly shrill. There are a couple of tracks where it is. So it's almost as if that's the last vestiges of the shrillness.
Yes, that's kind of what I meant.
But on this, yes, you're right. It's completely gone. Yeah, there's less of the Pavlov's dog about it, I think you could argue.
The transition from Hemispheres through to Moving Pictures, there was only one album in between. It is fantastic, really, you know, and a complete reinvention.
At the time, I would say I knew people who loved new wave, punk, progressive rock, metal, and they all loved Rush.
But that's interesting, because that's the other thing I suppose I hadn't mentioned before, is the transition in the lyrical approach from, say, two albums before. Hemispheres, still this kind of sci-fi hangover from kind of, you know, intellectual sci-fi, to something much more worldly. You know, much more about storytelling in the real world rather than this kind of fantasy world. And that's even reflected in the artwork too, isn't it? The change of artwork from say, Hemispheres to Moving Pictures. So, I mean, that's an extraordinary period of only 2 years when the band have really, you know, reinvented themselves and paid off for them commercially, didn't it? Massively.
It did. And to their credit, I think they continued to change throughout their career. I mean, if you listen to the next album, Signals, which is very synth oriented, again, you know, quite sophisticated musically, but it has a lot more in common with Ultravox than it does with 2112. And, you know, I think by Power Windows, they're kind of experimenting in a kind of ZTT fashion. In fact, I think they're using Psalm as one of their studios at that point. And, you know, they were clearly listening and clearly sort of evolving the sound. And somebody who we're going to discuss later, I think, produced them in the late 80s, early 90s, Rupert Hine. So they were very well aware of sound, and apparently Rush got Rupert Hine because they loved Immunity so much.
That's interesting. Well, we should talk about Immunity in a minute, because there is an argument to say that the reason you've chosen 1981, Tim, is just so you could talk about Immunity. And I, of course, readily agreed for exactly the same reason. But we're going to come on to that. Let's finish in this category of the sort of progressive and progressive sort of related. So also this year, we have Frank Zappa released three albums this year. Shut Up and Play Your Guitar, a three-album box set of guitar solos. Tinseltown Rebellion, a live album, You Are What You Is, and another double studio record. prolific as ever. Camel's Nude, which you've made a note here, one of the last traditional progressive releases by a traditional progressive band. And I think you're right. There's something about that that's almost like a throwback, isn't it, to this sort of great era of conceptual rock music of the mid-70s. And interestingly, their next record, they would go in a completely different direction. In fact, they made a record called A Single Factor, which was, you know, the title was ironic in the sense that it was deliberately almost trying to write pop songs and hit singles. But Nude, the previous album, was the complete antithesis of that. It's almost like an old school conceptual rock record.
Yes, you know, everything about it is traditional. It's a sort of great, languorous, mid-70s conceptual work with a good theme as well. And, you know, this was at a time when a lot of the other bands had shifted dramatically. So the Camel album was quite an anomaly, really.
The album I actually want to focus on is actually, it's another anomaly, really, because it's not really, it's not a progressive rock album in any way. It just happens to be made by someone who is associated with that genre. And this is Nick Mason's Fictitious Sports album. Now, it's interesting because this is one of those albums that I think is an absolute masterpiece, but you'll see plenty of terrible reviews of it all over the internet, partly because it just doesn't belong to the world that I think Nick Mason fans are expecting music, you know, the music he makes to belong to. This is essentially a sort of very playful experimental jazz record, isn't it?
A Carla Bley album produced by Nick Mason is kind of how I see it. And he's given it the Nick Mason name to boost her because he rated her very strongly as a composer. And she is an extraordinary composer, you know, in terms of her use of harmony and in terms of her extraordinarily sort of withering and sarcastic lyrics. You know, she's a real talent. And like you, I kind of bought it at the time and I really liked it. But mainly I liked it because I was a huge Robert Wyatt fan at that time, and anything with Robert Wyatt on would get me to part with my money, really, and probably still will, you know. And there's a couple of pieces on that which are hilarious while also being sad. There's one piece which is a kind of pastiche of minimalism as well, which goes through...
I'm a minimalist.
Which goes through every single minimalist cliche. And what's kind of interesting is that you think of 1981, by that stage, people like Steve Reich and Philip Glass hadn't really become household names in the way that they would. You know, Philip Glass...
No, I think that joke would certainly have been lost on most of the people that bought this record, including myself at the time. Completely lost. But I think you're right. So, I mean, that's interesting. I was going to say something similar to what you said, which is that there's this mixture of tenderness and this incredibly biting sarcasm.
Yes.
Sometimes within the same track. It's a fun record,
isn't
it?
Yeah, well, there's also that really beautiful... The one track I'd have thought that Pink Floyd fans would like is the Pink Floyd pastiche on it. I think it closes side one.
Hot River.
Yeah, which Hot is River, brilliant. Yes. And it is Robert Wyatt singing The Dark Side of the Moon. It's a gorgeous piece of music. Though, of course, you do feel as if it's ripping into Pink Floyd's legacy while producing this gorgeous piece of music. And I think there's another one. I've forgotten the title, but it's the track where he's basically talking about his own depression. And it's done in a way that is hilarious while also being almost tear-jerking.
But an incredible record and really still sounds like nothing else to me, apart from perhaps the rest of the Carla Bley, Michael Mantler catalogue. But they definitely create, or she certainly created a very, very unique musical world of her own, didn't she? And this is probably the most famous record she made by virtue of the fact that it had a member of Pink Floyd's name on the front cover. And, you know, and I'm very happy about that because that's why I bought it at the time. And that's why I fell in love with it. And I gave it a chance. So
I was going to say, it's almost like a sort of Carla Bley greatest hits album. Because I agree with you that basically it is my favourite Carla Bley related release. And it's almost as if she's giving everything. It's like every aspect of her style is on that album in some respects. It's a great calling card for her talent.
Anyway, let's move on. I think 1981, my favourite category for 1981, this is the music that was really arguably the most exciting of all in 1981, was the world of electronic pop music. And there's a long list of records that came out this year that are all, in many ways, all seminal records. Human League's Dare, you know, one of the most influential pop records made, certainly in England anyway. Soft Cell's Nonstop Erotic Cabaret, Ultravox's Rage and Eden, Duran Duran's first album, Spandau Ballet's first album, Heaven 17's Penthouse and Pavement. We could do a whole episode on just on that record, I think, alone, if we wanted
to.
Yeah,
brilliant record, yeah.
Amazing. Depeche Mode, Speak and Spell, their first album, you know, one of the most important, if not the most important electronic pop acts of all time. Associates' Fourth Drawdown, Gary Numan's Dance. But I think there's a couple that you and I particularly feel strongly about. Now, I can't remember if we talked about Simple Minds. I can't remember if Empires and Dance hit the cutting floor or not, but the follow-up album, Sons and Fascination, which was a double album, in fact, it was two separate albums packaged as one, to me is one of certainly one of the greatest albums to come from post-punk, electro. I mean, we've got it in the electro-pop category, but it's kind of spanning the world of post-punk and electro-pop, isn't it? Because There's still real drums, real bass on this record, lots of Charlie Burchill's sort of very angular post-Bowie Berlin-era guitar, that's still very much to the fore. Front, isn't it? But they're certainly taken on a lot of the affectations of what will become new romantic music, electronic pop. But it's odd, and also in the sense it's produced by Steve Hillage, which is obviously someone that's associated very much with the previous decade. And Steve was always very interested in electronic music and kraut rock music. So a lot of these songs are 6-7 minutes long, very repetitive. They don't have conventional pop structures. They're very much into that kind of hypno groove aspect of kraut rock. So you can hear elements of Can and Neu and Kraftwerk as well, can't you? Simple. I mean, I think maybe we talked about this when we did talk about Empires and Dance. A lot of people write off Simple Minds because I think they think of them as the band they became rather than the band they were. And that's not to say that what they became wasn't good too.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think part of the thing as well, what's exciting, as you say, one of the great qualities in this album is its relentlessness, its pursuit of ideas for ideas' sake. And it does sit between those worlds of post-punk and the burgeoning electropop scene. And what is also apparent in Simple Minds at this stage, and maybe they carried this on for a couple of years afterwards, but this is the last album where it's very much part of their identity. There's something quite esoteric about them. Lyrically, it never gives anything away. Visually, it never gives anything away. There's something about it which is abstract, but still quite affecting and exciting. And I think that obviously by the time they become that second-rate U2, as people perceive them, lyrically, it had become incredibly obvious, incredibly politicised. You could comprehend what they were about within two or three bars. And of course, you know, you do that well. That's an art in itself. But it's sort of interesting that a band that were almost a complete enigma, in a sense, became so open by the end of the decade.
Yeah, I think that's right. Just look at the titles on this record, and they're very, very kind of obtuse, aren't they? And you're not quite sure what they're talking about, but it's kind of drawing you in, and it's fascinating anyway. Which kind of leads us on, I think, to Tin Drum, doesn't it? Because that's exactly the same as what I would say about Tin Drum. Still Life in Mobile Homes, Visions of China, Sons of Pioneers. I mean, he's talking bollocks, isn't he, basically? utter bollocks. But wow, I love it. I love it. It's amazing. But anyway, musically, this album is just on another planet, isn't it? Just on another planet.
Well, it's amazing. I mean, obviously, we talked about Rush earlier, and one of the things that Rush and Japan had is that with each album, they were shifting dramatically into something else. By Tin Drum, this is a band that is suddenly completely out on its own. And even if there are elements of YMO, they've completely personalised them. You know, this is an incredibly exciting, innovative, very distinctive sounding album, partly because of the use of keyboards, which are extraordinary. The harmonies are very atypical of anyone at any time. You know, maybe Stockhausen, perhaps you can bring into the mix here. But it sounds very different, because we were talking about Hannett's production or the psychedelic production on Tear to Explode's Echo and the Bunnymen in there. This is an incredibly dry, unique soundscape that is all its own world, actually. I can't necessarily relate it to, you know, Talking Heads, Simple Minds, any of the other albums we're discussing.
I mean, Richard will tell you that all the keyboard sounds that sound like Yellow Magic Orchestra are all David's. I mean, I think, but you know, what's also interesting, you mentioned the keyboards, but like you say, that's not only that, is it? Because it's one of the last times you can listen to a band and you can listen to 10 seconds of that band and you can immediately identify every single member of the band. Mick Karn, obviously, the arguably the most distinctive bass player to ever stalk the earth. I mean, and Steve Jansen on drums as well. There's an argument to say that Sylvan is probably the weak link in the band. And maybe David even would concede it himself. I think he went on to become a much better artist as a solo artist than he was necessarily within the context of Japan. To me, the brilliance of Japan is the instrumentalists, the instrumental quality of an album like Tin Drum, that almost painterly like quality the music is put together, that doesn't seem to obey any rules at all.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think to a certain extent, whereas David Sylvian, I think, really finds his voice on Brilliant Trees, Gone to Earth, and particularly for me, Secrets of the Beehive, which I think is a beautiful album. On this, there's still perhaps a hangover of the Ferry influence or even some of the Bowie influence. So in some ways, you know, there's some great songs there. And obviously he was responsible for the song. So he's not exactly a weak link. You know, he's written some great material. But obviously it is what the band are doing with that material. They're almost ripping apart, you know, because I've heard versions of Ghosts where it's almost a straightforward acoustic singer-songwriter piece. And it's a great straightforward acoustic singer-songwriter piece. But in the hands of Japan, the band, it's an innovative masterwork. You know, it's gone somewhere else. So, you know, there's no doubt it's a collision of the two, because perhaps without Sylvian's songwriting, and even with his more recognisable Ferry-esque influence, you wouldn't have had the hooks that could have grabbed people.
It still sounds like something that didn't have a precedent and has never really been emulated. I think it's probably too hard to emulate. I mean, who could play bass like Mick Kahn, you know, or drums like Steve Jansen? And no one else has ever really sounded like Richard, you know, as a keyboard player. I mean, they're so distinct as musical personalities. Yeah,
yeah, and it's great that it kind of came from almost a kind of untutored background, that they just grew up as musicians and evolved and pushed one another to greater heights.
Well, that's fascinating too, isn't it? Because Japan started as a guitar band. And Richard will tell you that for the first few years, he was kind of always worried he was about to get fired because he wasn't quite sure what his role was in the band. And yet, a couple of years later, three albums later, his keyboards are at the very, very centre. And there's, you know, there's no guitar on this. Well, there is a guitar on one track, I think, is there or something, but there's hardly any guitar on the record at all, is it?
Well, I mean, this was the album after Robert Dean had left. And, you know, Robert Dean was a really good guitarist and I think really contributed a great deal to the previous albums. But I guess on this album, the guitar in any form was considered too conventional an instrument.
So there's one other album I wanted to just to give a brief, you know, minute or two to, because I do think it's another, part of the problem with this year is there are so many great albums you'd want to spend a lot of time talking about. Like we mentioned, the Heaven 17 record of Penthouse and Pavement, which are great, again, and a phenomenal record. But I think Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, Architecture and Morality is another album I just want to just spend a moment talking about, because they're a strange one too, aren't they? You can't imagine two guys on paper being less cool and any more nerdy than Andy McCluskey and Paul Humphries from OMD. And this record is full of sounds like, you know, mellotrons. There's mellotrons on here. In some respects, it's got a lot of the sort of Kraftwerk DNA that you would expect from most electro-pop bands. But it's very, very northern again, isn't it? Because these guys, correct me if I'm wrong, these guys were also from Liverpool or the Wirral?
They're from the Wirral, yeah, I think. So they were part of the Liverpool post-punk scene, used to rehearse in the same place as Echo and the Bunnymen, Teardrop Explodes and so on. And
so they've got that, haven't they? Yeah, they've got that kind of northern miserabilism. But also what I love about this record, I've not seen anyone else do this, I don't think, is they wrote a song called Joan of Arc, which they weren't happy with. At least the record company didn't think it was a single. So they wrote another song called Joan of Arc and put both of them on the same record, both called Joan of Arc, both were released as singles, and both were massive hits.
Yes.
What are the chances of that?
Very conceptual. Yeah. No, I mean, I think that OMD were always kind of smarter and more experimental than people think because of their hits.
I mean, they did look like their mums knitted their jumpers on Top of the Pops, didn't they?
I think so. And I quite like that about them.
OK, Tim, let's talk about Roops. Rupert Hine, the late great. He just passed away in the last 6 months or so. Rupert Hine's music. It's funny, when we started talking about doing this show and the whole concept behind it, I think one of the reasons we wanted to do it is because we wanted to, not only this record, but there were certain records we felt we wanted to evangelise about because they're so underrated and unknown. And to us, they're very, very, very special records. Like, for example, we talked about Van Morrison's Common One on the very first episode. We talked about Virginia Astley's From Gardens Where We Feel Secure. We talked about John G. Perry's Sunset Wading. This is another of those records, isn't it? Rupert Hine, Immunity. How do you talk about this record, Tim? How do you explain kind of what musical world this is from, for a start?
I think it's a fantastic album. I mean, what it is, it's in that category where there are very, very few albums. And we seem to like all of them. I'd say that you're talking about Gabriel 3, Gabriel 4, Kate Bush, The Dreaming, where every sound is processed to the nth degree. Really kind of inventive art pop.
Yeah, there's a definite strong emphasis on sound design in all the songs. I mean, they all feel like little short stories, don't they, the songs? And obviously you'd expect that from a producer. But obviously, you know, the other thing is I just love his voice. He's not got perhaps the same, you know, soul element to his voice like Gabriel. But his voice is very rich and very engaging, yeah, despite that. So I kind of think of him certainly in the same territory as the artist you're mentioning. But I also think of him very much as being contemporaries of this record, being a contemporary of, say, what Godley and Cream were doing, yeah, on a record like Freeze Frame. I mean, a song like I Pity Inanimate Objects, I could totally see Rupert also doing, yeah, something along those lines on one of these records too. And lest we also forget, this is the beginning. This is the first in a run of three albums, which I very much think of as a trilogy in the sense that they're all just as good as each other. Because, I mean, for anybody that's interested in production, as of course I am, and sound design, allied to sort of great, imaginative, ambitious pop writing.
Partly because of where he came from, he was doing something very different. You know, he'd produced people like Kevin Ayers and Caravan Camel. They produced Camel, Anthony Phillips. Mm. So he'd come very much from a kind of art rock, progressive rock background. But what was really exciting about this album was it sounded like nothing he'd ever done before. You know, this was a scorched earth policy. And I think this is kind of interesting, isn't it? That, you know, we're talking about a few bands here, like, you know, Japan with Syndrome, Rush with Moving Pictures, Rupert Hine with Immunity. It's almost like in 1981, they make these albums that seem to come from nowhere. It's like they've completely reinvented themselves, and it is some kind of scorched earth policy. And that, as we both know, is incredibly difficult to achieve. You know, you can progress as an artist, you can evolve, you can subtly shift your sound, but it's difficult to escape yourself and become something entirely different.
Anyway, that's definitely one of our tips for the most underrated, under the radar records, Rupert Hine's Immunity, particularly if you like any of the references we've kind of talked about. So other solo mavericks this year, Peter Hamill's Sitting Targets, one of our favourites on the show. We always talk about Peter. Bill Nelson's Quit Dreaming and Get on the Beam. Ditto, really, another of our favourites. Todd Rundgren's Healing. Ricky Lee Jones' Pirates. But the other solo maverick record we want to talk about is Phil Collins' Face Value. His first solo record, which again is an album that kind of defied all the odds, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Both in terms of musical approach and the phenomenal international success. And not only those have defied the odds in that sense, defied the odds in the sense that the biggest hit single off it, In the Air Tonight, should never have been a hit single. Mm. It doesn't sound like a hit single. It does everything wrong. It does everything that a hit single is not supposed to do. It's this kind of brooding drum. This song would never in a million years get on the radio now, would it? It would never in a million years get playlisted by anyone now. But somehow in 1981, songs like Japan's Ghosts and, yes, Phil Collins' In the Air Tonight could get on the radio, playlisted on the radio, and become massive
hits.
Yeah,
become top five. I mean, Laurie Anderson's Oh Superman, I think, was this year as well, wasn't it?
Laurie Anderson's Oh Superman, yeah. How did this happen? And, you know, it's sad in a way, this could never happen now. But here's a great example. Phil Collins, even though he was already an established, successful musician, he was the balding drummer of a band that were considered, in 1981, to be dinosaurs.
Sure.
Right?
He got on the cover of Melody Maker. He was treated quite seriously by NME. We forget this because by the mid part of the decade, he's persona non grata. And I can tell you that, you know, when we have Burning Shed Zoom meetings, I can put anything as a backdrop. Nothing will generate more ire and mockery than when I put Phil Collins' Face Value behind me, the cover.
It's a great record.
Brilliant record.
I mean, the interesting thing is I always think of Face Value as being the other side of the coin of John Martin's Grace and Danger.
Yeah.
because they're both essentially albums that are very melancholic in tone about their breakups with their long-term partners. And lest we forget, they were hanging out together. And Phil, I think, is the drummer on Grace and Danger, isn't he? And I think he maybe produced the following record.
Which is really good. Yeah, he did.
So they're kind of hanging out together. They're kind of drinking buddies. I think there's a lot of sort of crying into their beer, sort of, or crying into their brandies or whatever it is they're drinking going on here about the fact their wives had essentially left them. And that tangible sense of despair, which goes right through Grace and Danger, is absolutely present on Face Value too, isn't it? And I think that's one of the things I really, you know, love about it. It's kind of wallowing in its own sadness in a way. But for whatever reason, it also has the kind of accessibility and sheen about it that Grace and Danger apparently doesn't have. I think maybe just his voice is just... It's just a great pop voice, isn't it? He's just got that great pop voice.
It is an amazing voice. And the thing is, in some ways, again, he's being very true to himself. There is an aspect of Scorched Earth on this, because I think In the Air Tonight, although you could argue it comes out of his work with Gabriel on Gabriel 3, there aren't very many precedents. And as you've said, it's an extraordinary single. You know, this lasts for minutes with very simple synthesizer tones. You know, it's not that far off Ghosts in terms of its structurelessness, if you like. And it's a very affecting lyric and vocal. But I think what's kind of forgotten in retrospect is that although, that, you know, by the mid-80s, I think he'd become associated with Sussudio and a certain kind of commercial, definitively 1980s sheen, I think at that point, people were oddly still open to it. And I was very surprised at the time that given that Genesis were perceived as dinosaurs, he got very sympathetic interviews and reviews in The Enemy and Melody Maker at that time. So he was they realised that this was a complete shift in direction. And of course, names like John Martin were being brought up. So people were saying, you know, God, this is amazing. It has the kind of experimentalism of Gabriel 3, but he's fusing that with the emotional, heartfelt qualities of Grace and Danger. And I think Grace and Danger had been a very well-regarded and well-reviewed album at the time. And so maybe people were sort of seeing it in the light of that album rather than Genesis Duke, I suppose. And this was him stepping out of the Genesis role. And again, a bit like the Carla Bley, it's a bit like a greatest hits album in the sense that you have him at his most experimental, him with big band jazz influences, him with fusion influences, even that kind of really affecting country banjo ballad. The Roof is Leaking. You know, this quite a lot of diverse material, but, you know, some of the most affecting material is the most obviously R&B ballad. I think, you know, If Leaving Me Is Easy is one of the most...
I love that song, yeah.
Wonderful pieces of that era.
I mean, that's a track that could be on Grace and Danger, isn't it? I mean, if you think of songs on Grace and Danger, like Baby Please Come Home, you know, I mean, If Leaving Me Is Easy is definitely, you know, a very close relation to a song like that, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, it's another anomaly in a year that seems to be full of them. We should probably just, again, remind people that, you know, we are middle-aged white men who grew up in the 80s. So a lot of what we're talking about on this show is definitely a reflection of that. But let's move into different genres that perhaps take us slightly more out of our comfort zone. Metal. So it was a pretty good time for metal, wasn't it? Because we were kind of in the sort of halcyon days of new wave of British heavy metal. Lots of metal bands have got signed, got big record deals off the back of you know, that movement, your Maidens, your Saxons, your Def Leppards, and that. And the kind of bands that are destined to become the long-term successes are beginning to establish themselves. And perhaps some of the also-rans are falling away. So this year we have Iron Maiden's second album, Killers. Now, I'm a big apologist for the first two Maiden albums. I think they're my two favourite Maiden albums. I love the more punky edge of the Paul Di'Anno albums.
Yeah.
The first album for me is an absolute classic. Killers is a little bit more of the same, but that's not a bad thing necessarily.
There's something about those first two Iron Maiden albums that is very gritty, very grubby, very London. There's a kind of punk edge, not new wave edge. There's a kind of really grubby urban punk element to it. And they managed to merge prog, metal and punk pretty naturally, I think, on those first two albums.
We've also got the Mighty Sabs with Mob Rules. We've got Saxon's Denim and Leather. We've got Venom's Welcome to Hell, which I think was the first Venom album, which a band that were going to become very influential probably 10 to 15 years later with the Scandinavian black metal scene. Mm-hmm. Venom was seen as you know, sort of precursor to that whole scene. Michael Schenker Group, MSG, Def Leppard's High and Dry, their second album. Ozzy Osbourne's Diary of a Madman. So these are all really strong entries in the sort of canon of metal. I suppose we're in an interesting period here, aren't we? Because we're kind of before the era of sort of so-called hair metal. We're before the era of the Motley Crues and the Guns N' Roses, where metal became more glam. It's still got that sort of urgency and down-to-earth quality. Def Leppard have yet to have their big sort of breakout crossover records. So there's still that kind of, you know, we mentioned it before, that kind of punk edge to a lot of this music, but also an edge that relates back to things like early Judas Priest, early Thin Lizzy, early Black Sabbath, a more kind of dry, parched production. There isn't the big massed harmony, walls of harmony vocals. There isn't the big sort of, you know, gunshot snare sounds yet. It's still got that aesthetic of being a relatively, almost that kind of DIY aesthetic, which is personally what I like. Yeah. I like
it's kind of coming though, because you can hear it, you know, Def Leppard's High and Dry. They are going to evolve into that. UFO's album of this year is quite FM compared to what they'd done previously. And then you've got the American FM rock bands who sort of emerged in the mid to late 70s. And I'd say kind of Boston is almost like the progenitor of that.
Let's move on. Jazz. Perhaps not a vintage year for jazz. I mean, we've talked about this before, how the mid-70s was kind of like a watershed time for jazz as it became more, moved more towards the kind of smooth CTI sound. Artists like Deodato having big crossover hits, and a lot of other jazz musicians kind of wanted a piece of the action. So there were, you know, artists like Weather Report making albums like Black Market and Heavy Weather, more kind of accessible commercial jazz. So we get to 1981. ECM always keep the flame. They're sort of almost a guarantee of some quality. And we have some great records on ECM this year. Keith Jarrett's Invocations, Moth and the Flame, which is not a jazz record at all. Mm. You know, I mean, Keith Jarrett's one of those artists that has just gone completely outside of the genre with which he's traditionally associated. Invocations is a record he made on a church organ, and Moth and the Flame is a solo piano record. Wonderful record, a very unpredictable artist. You never knew what Keith, particularly in the 80s, actually, you never knew what Keith Jarrett was going to do next. So a very unpredictable artist right through the 80s. I'm sure jazz aficionados didn't really know what to make of him, which is a great, great thing as far as I'm concerned. Pat Metheny and Lyle Mays, As Falls Wichita, So Falls Wichita Falls. That's a bit of a mouthful, isn't it?
It is.
Tell us about this record, Tim.
Well, I think it's possibly the best album, really. I mean, you're talking about Jarrett was continually shifting and making albums that really weren't jazz in any conventional sense. And that was good because I think, you know, jazz obviously in the 60s and 70s went through a very experimental phase. And unfortunately, I think by the late 70s, early 80s, you know, Weather Report was still making interesting albums. Overall, it had become a lot more conventional and a lot more traditional. I think people were looking back to the 50s, the classic kind of post-bop albums. But ECM, as you say, were kind of keeping that flame alive for jazz musicians being able to do whatever they wanted. So you were getting beautiful genreless albums by the likes of Pat Metheny, Ralph Towner, Oregon. The Pat Metheny and Lyle Mays album has a sidelong textural suite. You know, it's as close to Vangelis as it is to jazz, but the harmonies they're using are kind of influenced by Brazilian folk music. And a lot of the rhythms are coming from Steve Reich. And of course, he was signed to ECM at that stage as well. So they were probably very familiar with what he was doing. So it was an interesting kind of collision of electronics, minimalism, Brazilian harmonies, and that very fluid, distinctive guitar tone of Metheny's. Just a really strong, unexpected album that did extremely well. And I think John Sermon was also experimenting a lot with synthesizers around that time as well.
All these guys, John Sermon too, actually, they're fascinating musicians in the sense that, like Keith Jarrett, they're very unpredictable, aren't they? I mean, I'm thinking of Pat Metheny and what he's done, you know, over the last 25 years, he did a Noise album called Zero Tolerance for Silence, you know, which is awesome, as Mertzbau-esque. He did an album with Derek Bailey, free jazz album. He's done his albums with the Orchestrion, which is this bizarre kind of like musical instrument that he invented, I think, or somebody invented for him. I'm not too sure. And a lot of these records you would barely say could be, you know, considered jazz at all. And it's interesting to know, I think it's worth pointing out that ECM, although they're nominally known as a jazz label, of course ECM stands for Editions of Contemporary Music, and I think Manfred Eicher, the guy who set up the label, also had always had visions that it would be much more than just a, you know, a simple quote-unquote jazz label. And of course ECM became as much known for its neoclassical music as its jazz music, starting around this time, as you're right, because they signed Steve Reich and they had Arvo Pärt, and then later on they had all these other sort of classical artists coming to the label. And it's interesting, you see that reflected in the so-called jazz artists too. I mean, making almost kind of having pretensions at being... One of the very early Keith Jarrett records on ECM was a record called In the Light, which was his string quartets and a brass quintet and, you know, pieces he was writing in a serious classical mode. So I think that's the beautiful thing about this label. There is that sense always that the so-called jazz musicians always seem to be much more eclectic and diverse than you would ever expect a jazz musician to be. And Pat Metheny and Lyle Mays, of course, passed away quite recently, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Another ECM artist around this time I really liked was Meredith Monk. Again, she was signed to ECM and releasing albums and producing some extraordinary albums of kind of vocal compositions.
Yeah, I mean, she's not jazz at all, is she? She comes almost from the performance art background, doesn't she? Yeah. Also this year we have Miles releasing his big comeback record after the big hiatus of the 70s, at least in terms of studio terms. I think there was a live album, wasn't there? But or maybe it was after this, I'm not sure. The Man with the Horn. Now, the thing I always think about The Man with the Horn is it's actually a good record, except I don't think Miles is playing that well on it. And I think the hiatus has kind of taken its toll on him. Two records that we both like very much from this year. I love both. I think, Tim, you definitely love the Grace Jones record, at least. Grace Jones Nightclubbing and Prince Controversy, which to me, being a massive Prince fan, only suffers because it came after Dirty Mind, which is such a landmark masterpiece for me. Controversy seems a little bit like more of the same for me, but that's not to say that it's not a brilliant record, which it is. And Grace Jones Nightclubbing, you know, part of a trilogy of records, I suppose, that she made around this time, with they're all made in very quick succession in the Bahamas with Sly and Robbie as her rhythm section. And there's again there's a kind of connection to the New York world of artists like Talking Heads.
Yeah, it fits beautifully. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I was going to say, I think her delivery, which is so detached, so ice cold, fits with the post-punk language of the day. I mean, so again, she's kind of got this funk aspect, this R&B aspect. There's also the kind of post-punk dance culture that's emerging in New York. So weirdly, she fits beautifully with so many scenes that are happening in, you know, 1881.
It's true. I hadn't thought about it. Yeah, because, of course, she covers She's Lost Control from Joy Division, and she also covers Warm Leatherette by The Normal.
Which is great.
So, and her version, I think, is the definitive version.
It's a bit like the Prince Controversy in the sense that Warm Leatherette was so good and such a statement that Nightclubbing, as strong an album as it is, seems very much like part two. It didn't quite have the shock value. The material's great, the title track is particularly stunning, but there is a sense of it repeating what Warm Leatherette has already set out, which is no bad thing, because I love Warm Leatherette.
Okay, so we're running out of time, Tim, so we should just quickly recap on some of the other things we haven't spoken about yet. Just general rock and pop records. ELO's Time, love that record. ABBA's The Visitors, their final record, which is a masterpiece. We've talked about ABBA before on the show, so we won't talk about them again here. Squeeze, East Side Story, Elvis Costello and the Attractions Trust, Madness 7, Adam and the Ants, Prince Charming, Face Dances by The Who and The Rolling Stones, Tattoo You. And then in the world of... Oh, well, you've got the electronic category, yes. Oh, yes, well, there is one album here I did want to talk about a little bit. Just to recap on other records from this year, Kraftwerk's Computer World. Of course, we could wax lyrical about that album forevermore, but I think Kraftwerk are almost part of the canon now these days, aren't they? And I've been discussed and perhaps over-discussed. Computer World is just a phenomenal record that was so influential. It's ridiculous. But we won't talk about it here, because I want to talk about the dark twin of Kraftwerk's Computer World. Deutsche, Amerikanische Freundschaft, which is a bit of a mouthful. And their album, actually, they made two albums this year, but the first album, Alice is Good, All is Good, is the breakthrough record. The band were originally a post-punk group with about five or six members, and they made some very, very sort of interesting post-punk music. Suddenly, they were down to a duo of a drummer and a singer. And they came out with this record called Alice is Good, which is basically drums, voice, and sequencer. And that's pretty much all there is to it. It's a very, very small musical palette. But what they do with it is incredible. And it is very similar to the Kraftwerk in you can almost can't imagine anything more Teutonic than the sound of Daff. Singing in German, but in a way that sounds good. The way that Rammstein sounds good to people who don't speak German, Daff sounds good to me too. And they have a very infamous song on this record, which was a kind of almost hit, called The Mussolini. Do the Mussolini, which is like this stomping dance track with just this propulsive sequencer and propulsive drum pattern. And then the singer, Gabby Delgado Lopez, basically singing, do the Mussolini, dance the Adolf Hitler over the top. Like the sound of that?
Yeah.
I love this. This is like the evil twin of Kraftwerk. This is like the bastard offspring of the classic krautrock of the 70s, the repetition, the propulsiveness, the kind of detached archness of it, the irony. And I absolutely adore it. It's like electro-punk. And it's basically all you need to know about this one band. All you need to know about this band is in this one song, because basically everything on the next three records was the same. It would be a sequencer pattern that would start off. A fantastic sequencer, by the way. I don't know what keyboard they use, but I love the sound of the sequencer. This kind of demented, out of control sequencer would start up. And then the drums would sort of kick in a very kind of repetitive way. No drum fills allowed. No drum fills allowed. Just this kind of motonic pulse. And then this Spanish-born singer would start intoning in German over the top.
And there's also the dark wave to come. I mean, this sound defines a lot of German electronic music of the next 20, 30 years, really. It's very stripped down.
Right, it does. Yeah.
And as you say, in a way, it's kind of, you know, the only precedent I can hear is maybe Suicide. There's an aspect of Suicide in this sound. But in some ways, it is like punk music being played on synthesizers, but there's a kind of a sultry,
absolutely,
you know, but there's a sultry understatement that punk doesn't necessarily have, which is why I guess I prefer Daff to Sham 69. Yeah, as you say, it's an incredibly German sound. It could be none other.
So also this year from the world of electronic music, Vangelis, Chariots of Fire, and John and Vangelis, the Friends of Mr. Cairo, Jean-Michel Jarre's Le Chant Magnétique, Yellow's Clara Kisei, YMO's Technodelic, and Tangerine Dream's Exit. Also, what else have we got we haven't talked about? Oh, well, you've got a category here called Experimental. I think this is where you've tended to put sort of outliers, things like the Penguin Cafe Orchestra's second album. Now, I think I'm right in thinking that we talked about the first album, didn't we, when we did the, I guess it would have been the 1976 episode, yeah. So a bit more of the same, but they inhabit such a wonderfully kind of unique world anyway of their own, don't they, that it's no sort of criticism to say that they're kind of doing more of the same here on this record.
No, it's another charming album. It's maybe not quite as interesting as the debut in some ways, but it's a great record.
So there's one final category that we should recap on. We did talk at the beginning of the episode about the Northwest regional post-punk, which is very specifically about the post-punk music that came out from Manchester and Liverpool. But of course, there was some other fantastic music from a scene that was still really, you know, very, very much at a peak at this time. Susie and the Banshees, Juju, The Cure's Faith, which, I mean, I just love that record, but we've talked about 17 Seconds and it's kind of more of the same, isn't it? In the best possible sense of the word. The Sound from the Lion's Mouth, very underrated post-punk group. The kind of almost sort of nodded towards the stadium, you know, sound of bands like U2 a little bit too, didn't they? Ditto, Concert Angels.
Yeah. Well, I think you're right. I think those bands, kind of Concert Angels, The Sound, they're in between Joy Division and U2. And they've got something of both. They've got that kind of anthemic quality of U2, but they've still got that really quite stark, unique, parched post-punk production.
Yeah. And ditto Psychedelic Furs, I think, with their album from this year, Talk, Talk, Talk. And then we've got the so-called beginnings of the sort of goth scene, you know, along with The Cure, The Birthday Party, Prayers on Fire, one of Nick Cave's earliest works, of course, in the context of that band. Bauhaus Mask, their second album. Au Pairs, Playing with a Different Sex. The Stranglers, La Folie, came out this year. Matt Johnson, who later became started working under the name of The, released his first album this year, Burning Blue Soul. So another icon to come, starting out on his musical path this year. And Eyeless in Gaza, Photographs as Memories, their first album. Mm. A favourite of ours, Tim, over the years, hasn't it, Eyeless in Gaza? Martin Bates and Eyeless in Gaza, we've been kind of curious about them over the years, haven't we?
Well, I think the thing about Eyeless in Gaza is that they fitted in with that post-punk vocabulary, but they always had something that little bit more fragile, human and earthy. You know, there was kind of a traditional folk element that was even in the earliest albums by that band. And I think that as the band evolve, you know, and they evolve in experimental ways with electronics and a lot of drum experiments in particular, but there's something, maybe it's in Martin Bates' voice, that I always think has a kind of an ancient folk, almost shamanic quality.
Did we not talk about the Murder Ballads?
We did, didn't
we? We talked about the Martin Bates, Mick Harris Murder Ballads album, yeah. But Eyeless in Gaza, the thing I love about Eyeless in Gaza is that they never seem to get out of the bedroom. Do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah.
That even 5 or 6 years, 5 or 6 albums into their career, they still sounded like it was just a couple of guys having, you know, fun on their sort of Porter studio in their bedroom.
Yeah.
It's a very DIY aesthetic. It didn't seem to have aspirations to be anything bigger than it was. And it's very charming and very intimate. And again, it has a sort of lo-fi thing right through their career.
Yeah, I suppose the thing I liked about Eyeless in Gaza, as you say, I think on one level, this is music made purely for themselves. They're not writing it for an audience. They're not writing it for success. And I guess what kind of distinguishes them from a lot of the post-punk bands is that there's no archness in Martin Bates' voice. He doesn't have that clipped quality that was very fashionable. And you can even hear in Grace Jones, as we were talking about. His voice is from a different place altogether.
Great. Shall we leave it there, Tim? That's a lot of records we've covered in a very short space of time. And so basically, if we haven't mentioned your favourite band or your favourite artist, it is because we hate them. It's nothing to do with ignorance and us not knowing it at all, right, Tim? It's actually because we know it all, we just hate it and we don't want to talk about it.
We know everything. I think you know, it's one of the facts the album years has established beyond any of
it. It's also worth pointing out that if you are interested in hearing any of the music we talk about, we do put together a playlist on Spotify based on each episode we've done. So there will be, within 24 hours of this episode going up, there should be an episode dedicated to 1981 where myself and Tim choose choice cuts from some of the albums we've talked about. So, Tim, the last thing that remains to be done, as we do always, as is customary at the end of the show, is we choose if push comes to shove, our favourite or favourites, if we can't come down on one in particular, and the album that we feel is the most influential. So you go first.
I mean, I find it almost impossible because, I mean, the one thing I remember from this year is that I love...
Say that every time.
Ah.
You say that every time. So I find it almost impossible.
Come on. When we did 1973, I said Dark Side of the Moon without any hesitation. Whereas you were going,
oh, I've heard it so often, I can't listen to it anymore. It isn't even music to my ears.
I wasn't quite saying that, yeah.
I think you said that in that exact voice, if I remember correctly. I mean, there were a lot of albums that I played quite a lot during this year. And actually, you know, again, even Squeeze East Side Story, I thought that was one of their best albums with some fantastic singles. There were great singles this year, you know, Oh Superman, I'm in Love with a German Film Star, Under Your Thumb, Godly and Cream. There are so many. In terms of album, I guess, you know, I played so many of these an awful lot. You know, looking through this list, it can be anything from, you know, the Catherine Wheel to Immunity to Face Value to Tin Drum to even Gary Newman's Dance and New Order's Movement. These are albums that I've played an awful lot.
Are you just going to list all the albums we've talked about again, Tim? Or are you actually going to choose one?
From Magazine's Magic, Murder and the Weather to,
I'm going to list
every album that we've listened to on this. Even The Stranglers' La Folie, it's a great album.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Pat Metheny, oh God. I'm going to go with Japan Tin Drum for both my favourite and the most innovative. I'm going to just cut it down to that one release.
I think that's a very, very good choice. I definitely would choose Tin Drum as one of my favourite albums of the year, if not my favourite album of the year. I'm just looking through the list quickly to see if there's anything else that would compete with it. And there are. The Nick Mason album, actually, I love.
Great.
Also, Simple Minds, Sons and Fascination. I'm not going to do what I've just accused you of doing and list every album again. Most influential. Is Tin Drum... Because we kind of talked about that. It didn't really begat much, did it, in the way of music that was influenced by it, or at least audibly influenced by it. This is a very hard album to sort of copy, wasn't it, in that respect?
Yeah, I suppose you're right. I mean, I'm thinking more in terms of production.
I think for most influential album, I'm going to go for the Kraftwerk Computer World, which has just been ridiculously influential. It's cast a shadow, really, over the whole sort of, you know, world of electronic music and pop in general ever since. And as its evil twin, the DAF album, Alice is Good, which, as you kind of pointed out earlier, is kind of the godfather of a lot of dark wave music, of which there is a lot in the world, it has to be said. So there we go. I think we'll leave it there. We'll try and edit this episode down to a manageable length, although we are getting more self-indulgent as we move into our conceptual progressive rock phase. Tim and myself, who started off making succinct 40-minute long statements, we're now into the worlds of sort of double and triple album, you know, sprawling concept records where people would say that would have made a great single episode, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, looking through, there are so many of these albums that still mean an awful lot to me. This is why I almost recited the list in its entirety for my favourite album.
Can we, on that subject, for our next episode, can we pick a year where we hate almost everything so that we can keep it down to about 40 minutes?
Well, obviously, in 1992, I think we found about two albums we actually liked, so that was
well, exactly,
bad.
Exactly.
Yeah, you want that?
So let's try and pick a year where we hate most of the music made, and then we can, you know, make it easy for ourselves basically by doing that. Yeah. Anyway, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this first episode of our second run at this absurdist, opinionated, factually incorrect show. And there will be plenty more to come. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye from Tim.
Goodbye.